hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and causing dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a hard fight. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought down the key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening, that's this morning, in the European heartland. Well, I was talking about Ernst Zundel, the late Ernst Zundel, the great Holocaust skeptic and revisionist publisher, who died at age 78 in Germany on Saturday of a heart attack. Ernst was a giant in his generation. And I've been telling the Ernst Zundel story about how he came to Canada as a 19-year-old in 1958. He set up a very successful graphic arts business, made a lot of money, made a big contribution to Canadian society. And then in the late 70s asked by members of his generation, members of the German community, for help. Because at that point, as you may well know, they invented this new religion of Holocaust. Prior to that, the stories of the Holocaust had been, a little bit sketchy. You know, first there was 11 million Jews killed, and then it was 7, and then that's 6 million. And there were various stories floating around of the sort, you know, lampshades made out of human skin, shrunken heads, and that type of thing. Now, I suspect few people seriously believe that any of that back then. Today, nobody believes that. However, I should say very few people believe that. The Holocaust lobby no longer speaks about that. However, the story had became quite well known, picked up a lot of steam with the television series, and then the courses began to be taught in schools, and then there were Holocaust memorials and so on. And what was happening is that children of German descent were coming home from school in tears because, in some cases, stupid or overly zealous or otherwise wise teachers would say, the Germans killed these poor Jews. The Germans, you know, not distinguishing between governments or a regime and a people any more than it would be fair to blame the Koreans for the behavior of the current maniac in Pyongyang, Kim Jong-un. Ernst tried to do something about that. He formed the Committee of Parents of German Descent and lobbied school boards and picketed theaters showing anti-German movies like The Boys from Brazil and anti-German newspapers like some of the columnists at the Toronto Sun. But he quickly began to realize that that what would work for any other group would not work for Germans. Or as he sometimes said about himself, there's one law for everybody else and a different law for Ernst. Well, there's one law of fairness for everybody else, but a different law for Germans. Now, why is that? Well, he believed, and he correctly so, was that a number of people had bought into this new religion of Holocaust. And therefore, stated or unstated, was the belief that the Germans deserved it. Even if people were unfair to German kids in schools, it was really their fault. Germans deserved it. And so Ernst realized that that he would actually have to deal with this thing called the Holocaust. And it was on that basis that he began to research the so-called Holocaust and realized that that there was something wrong, that the official story was, to be kind, wildly exaggerated. And so he began to publish literature critical of the so-called Holocaust. At first published widely published and distributed extensive pamphlet by Richard Verrall called "Did 6 Million Really Die?" And that was one of the first big holes in the Holocaust story. The Holocaust religion began to have a number of dogmas, and one of them was that 6 million and not a single body fewer Jews were killed by the National Socialists in World War II. This, of course, surprised me that. As information became available, this was not so. The numbers were very, very, very considerably lower. And I don't want to make this a broadcast about the so-called Holocaust, but it turned out that the Red Cross, which had the best access to the camps, said that Jews who died from all causes in the camps, not just in many cases sickness, in some cases hunger near the very end of the war, in some cases execution, numbered about 275,000. So it was not 6 million. And one of the interesting things about all that was the resistance to that. One would have thought, if this had been a normal historical debate, that history is constantly being revised, and reasonable people would have said, well, okay, wartime propaganda or mistakes, it doesn't even have to be propaganda, but it's possible that we can get things wrong. Well, there's no problem. We can revise it, and we have the new number. But you see, once it took on a self-serving folk history, tribal history of the Holocaust, took on a life of its own, and was being used not really so much for Jews, telling Jews what had happened to their compatriots, but it was rather a propaganda weapon to be used against us. Well, at that point, it was difficult to have that, to have variations in the story. You see, it might suggest, because it was being used as a propaganda vehicle, the fear, I guess, on the part of the people behind the Holocaust religion, was that once one dogma failed, the whole thing might fail. And you see, the difference between normal tribal history and the Holocaust is this. Normal tribal history are stories that people within the same group tell each other. This is our tribe's history. This is who we are. This is what we did. These were our triumphs. These were our defeats. And it's a way of unifying the group. And as such, there really is no great harm in it. Each group, and the fact that it's self-centered, again, there's no great harm in that. Each group will want to tell history from its own point of view, and with naturally with itself as the center of the story. Again, no great harm in that. However, this was unique in that this was a tribal history, not primarily for Jews, but for us. And the new religion of Holocaust, it was designed for a number of purposes. One was to keep us feeling guilty, irrationally guilty. And when I say us, I mean everybody in the West. Even though logically you might say, well, wait a sec, why should I as a Canadian or you as an American feel guilty about whatever it was that happened to the Jews in Europe? Because, well, actually, didn't we fight the guys who supposedly did it? No. It is an irrational, an orgy of irrational guilt to make us, to demoralize us, make us not like ourselves, and then it like religion, it can be invoked to manipulate us. For instance, if you criticize massive third world immigration, well, you're a Nazi. Well, why is a Nazi bad? Well, you want a Holocaust. Oh no, I don't want to kill any. I don't want to kill Mexicans. I don't want to kill these Haitian invaders pouring into Quebec. I just don't want them in my country. That's all. I don't want to kill him, but you see, it's manipulative. So Ernst went after that, and needless to say, it wasn't long before retribution came down upon him. He went through 9 years of legal battles. Jewish lobby twisted the arms of the Canadian legal system, and he was charged under a very obscure old law called false news. That law was eventually declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1992. But his troubles were not over, because at this point we were now into the age of the internet and discussion boards, and some of his views were now being publicized on something called the Zundel site, run by an American, Ingrid Rimland, who later became his wife, and in the United States. Now, you wouldn't think Canadian law would have jurisdiction over an American site. Well, that was a battle that went on for 5 years, 1997 to 2000. And in the end, Ernst lost, but in the end, Ernst decided, after being denied citizenship for the second time in Canada, to move to the United States, where he was on the point of getting his green card. He married Ingrid Rimland, who now, of course, became Ingrid Sundel. He was establishing with her an art gallery called Soaring Eagles Art Gallery just outside Sevierville, Tennessee, in Pigeon Forge. And it looked as though he was well on his way to getting his citizenship. Green card. However, Michael Chertoff, son of a rabbi, a dual American-Israeli citizen, dead-end Zionist, was then in charge of Homeland Security, and lo and behold, Ernst was picked up, arrested, charged with overstaying his visa, which he hadn't done. Later, courts admit that he hadn't. Deported from the United States to Canada. Canada invoked a post 9/11 piece of totalitarian legislation that was later largely ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of Canada, called the False News. I'm sorry, called the National Security Certificate. Ernst was held in solitary confinement, frequently denied necessary medical or dental care, and after 2 years of hearings, where under a regime that has since been declared unconstitutional by our Supreme Court, a regime where we were not allowed, a lot of evidence was secret. There were secret witnesses. We didn't know who they were or even really what they said. After fighting shadows before a judge, who two different lawyers on three occasions asked to recuse himself because he had been the boss as Solicitor General during part of the Brian Mulroney years, and thus in charge of CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, the very body who were deciding on the who were testifying against Aaron Sindel. So their former boss was going to be supposed to be able to objectively judge the evidence, much of it in secret. Well, he wouldn't recuse himself. We went to federal court, the Federal Court of Appeals. We couldn't get them to make him recuse himself, even though adults, intelligent people, knew that CSIS, being the spies, probably have something on every politician. Now, I'm not saying there are or were ghosts or skeletons in Pierre Blais' closet, but then the test for reasonable apprehension of bias is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just, would reasonable men wonder whether a man like this could render a fair judgment? And anyway, Ernst was railroaded through the system, eventually deemed to be a threat to national security, even though, at least on the public evidence, that threat was nothing more than the vaguest guilt by association. I'm going to tell this story again because it is so outrageous and ridiculous. You really have to hear it. Here was the public account of why Ernst Sundel is a threat to national security. Ernst Sundel is a terrorist. How would that be? Well, you know, he'd never been convicted of a violent crime in any country. He'd never been convicted of a crime in Canada. Ernst Sundel, he was a lifelong pacifist. He was a Seventh-day Adventist who came to Canada rather than the United States so as to avoid being drafted into the army. So here's a pacifist who's never committed an act of violence, never committed any crime in Canada, but somehow he's a threat to national, he's a terrorist. Well, how do you reason that? Well, it is a pretty convoluted. Here it goes. Ernst Sundel, sometime in the late 70s, attended two meetings where the speaker was Dr. William Pierce. Dr. William Pierce had founded the National Alliance. Dr. William Pierce also wrote some books. One of them was called, it's a novel called The Turner Diaries. In the early 90s, a man by the name of Timothy McVeigh supposedly had read The Turner Diaries and set off a bomb that blew up the Murrah building and killed 20-some people in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Therefore, Ernst Sundel's a terrorist. Do you get the connections? Right. Well, I don't think any reasonable person would. And any person with a legal background would laugh at it. Well, except the Canadian court, which bought it. Here are some of the problems with that. First of all, Ernst Sundel never joined the National Alliance. Ernst Sundel never donated to the National Alliance. He attended a lecture. Well, I've attended meetings where there are communists speaking. Does that make me a communist? Does that make me responsible for the Russian Revolution? Well, of course not. So that was Ernst Sundel's sole connection with the National Alliance. Dr. William Pierce wrote a novel.
Yes, he did.
We're told that Timothy McVeigh read it. Well, he may have. We're told that Timothy McVeigh was inspired to blow up the Murrow Building. Well, that's harder to know, but let's assume it's true. That would seem to be more an issue with Timothy McVeigh's brain.
William Pierce never told him to blow up the Murrow Building. Ernst Sundell never told him to blow up the Murrow Building. The connection is, to say the least, pretty far and tenuous. There's also considerable reason to doubt whether McVeigh actually did commit that. Anyway, the connection is unbelievable, guilt by association, and it was on that incredibly flimsy basis. This is the public information that Ernst Sundell was declared a threat to national security, and in early March 2005, he was surreptitiously deported to Germany. Now, not the normal way a person would be deported, which would mean he goes with the guard on a commercial plane and is flown to Germany. No, apparently, at taxpayers' expense, Ernst Sundell was boarded, was bundled onto a private plane and sent to to Germany. Germany, of course, had a warrant out for him. Why? Well, Ernst had questioned the Hollywood version of World War II in numerous tapes, videos, booklets, and so on. And he was duly convicted, sentenced to 5 years in jail, which was the maximum. One of his lawyers, Sylvia Stolz, was actually sent to jail for too vigorously defending him. That is the mark of a sad totalitarian state, where a person can be charged with, a lawyer can be charged with too vigorously defending a client. So Ernst spent 5 years in jail, emerging in 2010 under some parole conditions, and he largely went silent and spent his remaining 7 years refurbishing his ancestral home in Bad Wildbad in the Black Forest in southern Germany. Ernst, as I mentioned, had married Ingrid Rimland around the year 2000. He was never again to see her in the United States after 2003. Of course, after 2005, he wasn't allowed in Canada. He was not allowed to go back to the United States. He was under a 20-year ban. But a couple weeks before his death, in a statement signed by a Jew, it was determined that the Homeland Security would not allow, found Ernst Sundell forever inadmissible to the United States. So he and Ingrid would not be able to live out their final years together. They did meet from time to time, though, in safe third countries like Mexico or the Dominican Republic. What was done to this real hero? Ernst was, as I mentioned, was a graphic artist, but he was also a very gifted painter. One of the big ironies is that Ernst Sundell had largely given up being an active, or a revisionist activist in the year 2000, when he moved to the United States. He moved to the States largely to do other work. The work he wanted to do was to get back to creative art, not just the graphic arts, but creative art, painting, which had been one of his first loves. Also, he had an abiding interest in a form of farming that had been practiced in Germany in the 1920s, and it's a form of organic farming, and it's among other things, there's a strategy for planting
certain plants close together in a way that will drives bugs away. In other words, certain plants, I might be wrong on this, lettuce and tomatoes. For some reason, lettuce keeps certain bugs that infest tomatoes away. Anyway, he wanted to get into that, as he was very interested in alternative health methodologies and strategies. In fact, really, Ernst, as a revisionist, wanted to retire in 2000. Because, and I think this is quite reasonable, there were younger men ready to take his place. One particular was Germar Rudolph. And he felt that Germar had a scientific background. Ernst did not. Ernst was a graphic artist. He was a communicator. Germar had put out a series of good books on the so-called Holocaust. He was a leading revisionist, and he had, a chemistry degree from the Max Planck Institute in Germany. So Ernst, I think quite reasonably, was passing the leadership mantle to a younger generation, not insisting to be one of the leading revisionists to the end of his days. Very reasonable change in life, because he had never sought the revisionist movement. Took a major leadership role, but it was not something that had been his first love or desire. He felt he'd had to do it, first of all, in the pursuit of truth, and secondly, to try to restore the honor of the German people, who were being unfairly tagged with this guilt about the so-called Holocaust. So one irony about the Ernst Sundel story is that those who felt he was their enemy because he doubted the Hollywood version of World War II, as an enemy, he really was a man of the past by 2000. I wouldn't say totally out of that area, but largely out of it. He had retired. But, of course, these people are the never again, never forget, utterly vengeful individuals, and they pursued him, and even after death, and I'm going to come back to this after a short musical interlude, even after death, seek to trash his reputation and demonize him. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back in just a couple of minutes, going to take a short musical interlude, and I would like to play something in honor of Ernst, and I'll try to find this here. Well, I'm going to play something. I will come back to that in a moment. This is hope you'll like this. This is kind of a religious song here, and this is Jimmy Fortune with a Johnny Cash, Jim Carter Cash song called
What do you think that was about?
Called Farside Banks of Jordan. There we are. I hope.
Still, I've got a journey on my mind. Lures of this old world have ceased to make me want to stay. My one regret is leaving you behind. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout. First across Somehow I've a feeling when it comes your time to travel, likewise don't feel like I will be the first one that you'll see, and I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. When I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. Through this life, we've labored hard to earn our meager fare. It's brought us trembling hands and eyes. So I'll just rest here on this shore and turn my eyes away. Until you come, then we'll see paradise. But I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand. And when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand. And I'll be running through the shallow waters, reaching for your hand.
And that's Jimmy Fortune, and a song made popular by Johnny and June Carter Cash back there in the late 1970s. Now this is a song, the music, for a tribute by Robert Forresson to Ernst Sundel. And hope you like it. It's a really good patriotic German music.
Thank you.
is a this is actually part of a video tribute to Ernst Zirngel, but that's the music, and hope you appreciate it like that. And with great regret, we say goodbye to a great fighter for free speech. I'm going to conclude this short musical interlude with another song I hope you'll like. And this is with Rhonda Vincent and her brother Darren, as called Beneath Still Waters.
Beneath still waters is a strong undertow. The surface won't tell you what the deep water knows. Darling, I'm saying I know something's wrong. Beneath still waters, your love is gone.
Vincent and Beneath Still Waters. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. That's a good tune, but we've got to move on. I said that there had been a lot of really classless nastiness about Ernst Zirngel. In many ways, pathetic in the attacks on Ernst after he died. One of the particularly vile writers was a man by the name of Mark Bonikowski, who was the editor of the Toronto Sun, and well, I don't think he is now any longer the editor, but he is a columnist that has been around for a long time, and among the most tasteless reviews I have ever read is this writer, this obituary, written, I think, the day after Ernst passed away. I'm going to read that for you. Really disgusting. It concluded. I won't read all of it, but it concluded. When Zwingli was eventually released from that German prison, he complained his cell was no bigger than a chicken coop. Compared to the concentration camps where 6 million Jews lived and died, however, it was a five-star hotel. Well, that's if you believe that that was the case. Incidentally, Auschwitz, in the testimony that was heard at the in several places, actually has a swimming pool and a brothel. Hard to acquaint that with the Hollywood version of World War II, but so be it. Anyway, Mark Bonikowski went on to say, the fact that he was able to die at home in Germany of natural causes and apparently in robust health up until the heart attack hit is just another example of how life isn't fair. He deserved agony, but got none. Mark Bonikowski. Now, some people said that Bonikowski's a Jew. We haven't actually been able to track that down. He's, of course, 110% Zionist and had a decades-long hate-on for Ernst Zwingli, written in many columns. But imagine that as a remark after a person's died. He bemoans the fact that Ernst died in apparently robust health of a heart attack. But he deserved agony, but got none. Meyer Halevi of the Jewish Defense League in Toronto, and you would tend to expect this sort of this sort of mean-spiritedness. Ernst Zwingli is dead. The Jewish Defense League confronted this Hitler lover many times. Now it's time to party. Well, okay, party on. Some of the really low-class comments. Here's a commentary by Michael Hoffman, who is who covered the first Zwingli trial and the first Zwingli false news trial, and wrote a remarkable book called the Great Holocaust Trial, which you can still get from Michael Hoffman, and you can get it at his website is www.revisionisthistory.org. So www.revisionisthistory.org. And this is a written by Michael on August the 8th. Headline, well, he's quoting the headline from the Toronto Sun: Ernst Zwingli deserved agony, not a quiet exit. In our August 7th eulogy for the late Ernst Zwingli, this is Michael Hoffman writing, we alluded to the Talmudic mentality and the penchant of people afflicted with it for revenge and hatred, which they project on us, which they project onto Ernst Zwingli in paroxysms of rage and libel. No sooner had we published our tribute than Mark Bonikowski stepped forth to confirm our observation. Mr. Bonikowski writes for one of Canada's largest newspapers, the Toronto Sun. It's difficult to account for the fact that the Sun, which wears its human rights heart on its righteous sleeve, would print Bonikowski's disgusting column with its sadistic craving to see a pound of flesh extracted from Zwingli. But that's what's occurred. In the August 7th issue of the Toronto Sun, an article entitled, Believe It or Not, Ernst Zwingli Deserved Agony. Mr. Bonikowski was not content with the lifetime of persecution inflicted on Zwingli for his ideas, speeches, printing, and writing, including multiple costly criminal trials, 2 years imprisonment in solitary confinement in Canada, 5 years imprisonment in Germany, the burning of his home and its contents by an arsonist. Actually, the Jewish Defense League, under
the Jewish Defense League leader in the United States at the time, Irv Weinstein, several years later claimed responsibility for it. We know Weinstein was in Toronto at the time. Several days after the fire, he and an associate were caught by Ernst Zundel security people trying to wander around the burnt wreckage of Zundel's place, and they were thrown out. It was Irv Weinstein's boast that he torched Ernst's place, or was part of the effort that did torch it. And Ernst and Weinstein would die as a convicted criminal in prison, but not for that. Anyway, back to Michael Hoffman's column. In Bonkowski's Fevered Imagination, quote, Zundel deserved agony, but got none. The fact that he was able to die at home in Germany of natural causes and apparently in robust health up until the heart attack hit is just another example of how life isn't fair. These are grotesquely inhuman words, writes Michael Hoffman. What sort of mentality urges suffering and cruelty on a dead activist? It can be found here. Quote, Jesus shares his place in the netherworld, that's hell, with Titus and Balaam, the notorious archenemies of the Jewish people. Whereas Titus is punished for the destruction of the temple by being burned to ashes, reassembled and burned over and over, and whereas Balaam is castigated by sitting in hot semen, Jesus' fate consists of sitting forever in boiling excrement. And this is Peter Schaefer, from the book Peter Schaefer, Jesus in the Talmud, Princeton University Press. This is from one of the Jewish sacred books. This isn't made up. This is not some person who doesn't like Jews writing this. This is what they wrote. Jesus shares his place in hell with Titus and Balaam, the notorious archenemies of the Jewish people. Whereas Titus is punished for the destruction of the temple by being burned to ashes, reassembled and burned over and over again. Whereas Balaam is castigated by sitting in hot semen. I don't know what this hot semen stuff is. I know what semen is, but it's kind of a weird sexual fantasy, I think. Jesus' fate consists in sitting forever in boiling excrement. Michael Hoffman adds, what sort of mentality decries hatred of Jews, but approves hating Germans? It can be found here. Every Jew, somewhere in his being, should set aside a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate, for what the German personifies and for what persists in the German. Written by E.V. Wiesel, Legends of Our Time, Chapter 12, from Schocken Books, published in 1982. Listen to that again. Every Jew, somewhere in his being, should set aside apart a zone of hate, healthy, virile hate, for what the German personifies and for what persists in the German. Not some Germans or National Socialists or the head of the National Socialist Party, but all Germans. Now, that would probably be illegal under Canada's so-called hate law, if, of course, it was serious and applied to other than privileged minorities. Now, these are the very people, who endlessly point their finger and accuse the whole world or much of the world of hating them. It's hate this, hate that, hate literature, a big concern about hate. Well, who are the haters? This is, of course, a man who became synonymous with being an expert, a survivor of the Holocaust, so he said. The Elie Wiesel, though, would never show his tattoo, which he claimed he got in Auschwitz. But wouldn't show it. Why? Well, hard to know. Elie Wiesel, in January 1945, had two choices. He could wait in Auschwitz, or Auschwitz was being closed as a camp, shut down. Could wait for the advancing Russians, and that was one option that some prisoners took, or go west with the Germans. What did he do? He went west with the Germans. Wait a sec here. If you were being seen all sorts of people allegedly killed and these terrible Germans and they did all these dreadful things, why would you go with them? when you had the option of staying for the Soviets? Don't know. And the most fascinating thing, because Elie Wiesel died within the last year, there's a picture of Elie Wiesel getting out of, I believe it's Buchenwald. I think he was transferred to another camp in southern Germany. Well, Wiesel getting out of Buchenwald, in this picture, there's Wiesel and a number of other Jewish inmates. Well, how do they look? Well, Wiesel is fairly tall, robust looking, full face, curly hair, and the other Jews who are with him also look similarly robust and so on. These aren't walking skeletons, you know, all their hair has fallen out, bones practically sticking through their skin, not at all. I thought, remarkable. Well, he made a life's work out of denouncing Germans and promoting his own exceedingly fanciful view of the world. Joseph Meyer, a Jew, writing in Commentary Magazine, April 1st, 1963, wrote, "The anti-German bias of Elie Wiesel's article, An Appointment with Hate, Commentary Magazine, December 1962, is easily justified and need not be repudiated." So the anti-German bias of Elie Wiesel can be justified, says this Jewish writer, and need not be repudiated. And Michael Hoffman concludes, "Because few people with social standing have the courage to point out the megalomania and serious hypocrisy evident in the preceding, quotations, these malignancies grow unchecked, conferring upon our supposedly egalitarian society a Talmudic supremacism, consisting of special prerogatives for bullying and hating and marginalized dissidents and nonconformists, who have little or no voice in the mainstream media and are dehumanized with impunity to the glee of the guardians of human rights." And that is so very true. In most of the obituaries to Ernst Zirkel, or about our Ernst Zirkel, in the Canadian lamestream media, most of the, almost none of them, in fact, none that I have read, quotes an admirer of Ernst Zirkel. I don't mean to say that they should only quote them, but they certainly quote critics of Ernst Zirkel. All of them are distinctly unsympathetic. I haven't read a single one that was neutral, you know, simply gave the facts. All are highly judgmental, some almost psychotically so, like column by Mark Bonikoski in the Toronto Sun, filled with hatred in many cases, or editorializing, hate monger, and so on. But he was never convicted of hate in Canada. This is the remarkable thing. Accusations are reported as facts, and sober reflections on Mr. Zirkel are few and far between. And evidence of the malignity of much of the lamestream media is the fact that not a single one of the obituary writers, to my knowledge, has sought the views of any of Ernst Zirkel's supporters. I was one. I was his media spokesman, and basically did organizing for him during his 2 years in prison, in solitary confinement in Canada, 2003 to 2005. I'm readily available. My whereabouts are easily known, and so on. And there were other people, prominent people, who could have provided a comment about Ernst, or at least a balance. But to this day, the endless demonization of the German people continues apace. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.
I'll be back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. Show's repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. Oops.